From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gastina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
Coming up this week, the ruling coalition in the state Senate gains a member. Our political observer Alan Shartok shares his thoughts on the Senate leadership, and we'll take a look at how Common Core affects testing. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. The ruling coalition in the New York State Senate has grown by one member. Senator Tony Avella of Queens has left the minority Democrats to join the governing coalition of Republicans and independent Democrats. We get an update now from the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt.
Senator Tony Avella is a progressive-leaning Democrat who's been called a maverick. He says he's become convinced he can get more accomplished by joining the Senate's ruling coalition, which includes all of the Republicans and a few breakaway independent Democrats.
I've always considered myself a bipartisan person. I don't care whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. If you've got a good idea, I'm going to work with you and fight for it.
Senate Independent Democratic Conference leader Jeff Klein calls Avella's decision terrific. Klein says Avella, who he's known for a quarter of a century, is a good fit.
Tony Avella gets up every day with a very simple truth. How can I make a positive difference in the lives of the people I represent? And that's what the Independent Democratic Conference is all about.
Avella admits he was not always on board with the idea of a Senate ruling coalition that empowers the chamber's Republicans, who numerically are a minority in the Senate.
In the very beginning, I had some concerns that this bipartisan coalition with the IDC and the Republican Conference wasn't going to work. But it has worked.
Avella says he's co-sponsored a number of bills with GOP senators over the past couple of years, more than any of his former Democratic colleagues. Senator Avella's switch does not change the overall makeup of the Senate. The Republicans and independent Democrats are still in control. The rest of the Senate Democrats still hold minority status. Senate Democratic leader Andrea Stewart Cousins admits she was blindsided by Avella's announcement.
I read it.
Senator Cousins is philosophical about Avella's defection. She says the Democratic Conference continues to hold positions on key issues that polls show most New Yorkers support. And she says long-term demographics in a state with a decreasing number of Republican voters puts time on the Democrats' side. She says when you count up all of the Democrats in the Senate, including the IDC's now five members, Democrats already have more seats overall than Republicans.
The reality is I don't know how we hold back the tide, but I do know that if we, the nucleus of Democrats here who are strong and focused, continue to be that, we will get the majority, we will govern, and the people of New York will win from our leadership.
Governor Cuomo was not in Albany. Speaking in New York City, Cuomo dismissed the developments as political maneuverings.
I think we're headed into the political silly season, and you're going to see this battle continue in the election season.
The Republican Independent Democratic Alliance in the Senate has benefited Cuomo on some issues, including the enactment of a 2% cap in the growth of property taxes, but the GOP has opposed the governor on some other items, like a Women's Equality Act that includes an abortion rights provision and decriminalizing small amounts of marijuana. Nevertheless, Cuomo, who often boasts of his ability to work with both parties, says overall he's been satisfied with the balance of power at the Capitol.
This whole coalition government is working, and I want to keep it that way.
Senator Avella has sponsored a number of bills that have not had the backing of the GOP, including a moratorium on hydrofracking in New York State. He was noncommittal about the measure's future.
I'm, you know, big on anti-fracking, so I think is the IDC, and I'm going to continue to work on that agenda.
But he says now it may be easier to talk to the Republican senators about a fracking moratorium and other issues. In a statement, Senate GOP leader Dean Skelos called Senator Avella an independent voice and a straight shooter and said he'll be an asset to the ruling coalition. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now is Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. Well, Senator Tony Avella of Queens has joined the Independent Democratic Caucus.
You know, it's a very interesting story. They're beginning to pick off a few more. I've always believed, by the way, that the governor basically needs and wants the Republicans to be in power in the Senate. That slows everything down. He's a fairly conservative Democrat now, the way that he styled himself. And if he's got a Democratic majority in the Senate, they'll probably pass everything in sight, costing the state a lot of money. His father did the same thing with Warren Anderson and Ralph Marino. He does the same thing here. So he didn't veto the famous apportionment bill that he said he would as a staple of his first campaign, and he keeps him there. Now, obviously, he's going into an election now, and fascinatingly, he has to decide how he wants to play it. Tom Kaplan of the New York Times and other reporters have come up with a terrific story, which basically says Cuomo was trying to pick his opponent in the Republican Party, and that he doesn't want Rob Astorino, who is a moderate Republican from the Westchester region, where he's the county executive, and blew everybody away. So he, through intermediaries, according to this article, is trying to get the Republicans to nominate somebody who isn't as attractive as Astorino. Dick Nixon, remember a little thing called Watergate? He was going to win. He was going to win big. It cost him everything. They could have stuck a fork in him by the time it was all over. Chris Christie, huh? Did they really have to close down lanes on the George Washington Bridge because some minor league mayor from Fort Lee wouldn't endorse, Democrat endorsed the Republican? No, they didn't. They went too far. And it has probably ruined Chris Christie's chances to be president of the United States, where he was on the fast track. So, you know, one wonders if these people have too much time on their hands. And if this story is true, as portrayed in the august New York Times, then I got to tell you, it would appear that Andrew Cuomo is making the same kind of mistake.
A national group that seeks to lessen the influence of big campaign donors unveiled a $1 million advertising campaign aimed at promoting New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's public financing plan. Now, of course, as the article points out, whether it gets to the legislature is a whole other thing.
Well, yeah, you know, there's so much going on here that we don't know about. Let me put it this way. This governor has $30 million in his campaign fund and is fighting for campaign financing. On its face, you know, you can't doubt it. Hey, if he gets it through, it's all good. On the other hand, does he really want it? I mean, my feeling is he brings in Dean Skelos and he brings in Jeff Klein, the so-called Democrat who's gone over to the Republican side and keeps him in office and says, you guys aren't going to be in office if you fool with me and I need this thing done, and you do it. I have no doubt he could. Now, the Cuomo people tell me he can't. I say he can't. I say he's got those guys. He's the preeminent leader in New York State. I believe that the Democrats are in the minority, even though they have more people, because Cuomo didn't do what he said he was going to do about apportionment and the rest of it. So I believe that, you know, it's one thing to say you want something. It's another thing to prove it.
What do you think of it?
Oh, I think it's a terrific idea. I think that one of the great ways that you level politics is that you take some of the money out. You'll never take all of it out. But if you give Bernie the bartender a chance to run for office, he probably will. You know, I mean, he'll have to raise a certain amount of money himself or herself, if it's Bernie's, and then you get a chance to match it six times like they do in New York City. You get more people running for office, you'll diminish the role of money in politics. But the main thing is that you'd be on your way to a more equitable system. Right now, money is just ruling everything.
Will it happen in New York?
Well, it happened in New York City. I think it may happen in New York State. We know that every year Shelley Silver passes such a bill, one way or another, in the state assembly. But does he do it because he knows the Republicans are going to say no? That's the kind of question we don't really know until we see what they actually do as opposed to what they say.
Our political observer, Alan Chartung, joining us. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The New York Farm Bureau discussed its national agriculture priorities during a conference call this week. Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley was on the line and filed this report.
The Empire State's largest farm lobbying group has already outlined its state legislative priorities, which focused on economic initiatives such as farm-to-market transportation and enhancing state investment in agriculture. The New York Farm Bureau is now eyeing what Washington needs to do to help the rural sector. President Dean Norton says the group's primary issue at the congressional level is immigration reform.
We're looking for a stable workforce on our farms so that we can secure the rural economy and secure the local food supply that we all need. Without immigration reform, that may suffer. We support efforts to keep the workers who are already here on our farms, and we're also looking for a flexible guest worker program.
Norton says immigration reform is crucial to New York's diversified agriculture industry, with all sectors from dairy to fruit and vegetable farms at risk. With debate so fluid inside the Beltway, Norton noted certain provisions are required to aid New York agriculture.
One of the most important things in the legislation is to make sure that those workers that are here now have a pathway to some type of permanent residency and some way to allow them to remain in agriculture so that we have a safe and reliable workforce. That would be number one. Number two would be to make sure that the rules are the same for everyone across the country. Whether you're in the Northeast region, West, South, Midwest, that we're all playing under the same rules. And number three is, we stated earlier, to have a legal process where we can have a flexible guest worker program so that we do not have to come back to the drawing board, to Congress, again, something that can be longstanding and permanent.
The second federal concern Norton outlined is implementation of the recently passed Farm Bill.
The Farm Bill has been passed, but that's only half of the job. The other rest of the work is now working with our friends at USDA and our partners in the legislature and with the other ag organizations to make sure that the laws that were passed with the recent Farm Bill passage, that the rules that are made in the way that they are helpful to our New York farmers.
Senior Associate Director of National Affairs Kelly Young adds they will be vigilant for any changes in regulations.
Every time new regulations are proposed, we're checking to make sure that they're both warranted and that they have a public benefit. So many times new regulations cost our farmers more money, money that they can't pass on to their consumers, which undermines their ability to stay in business.
Young points to proposed changes in safety standards as an example.
One of the concerns of our farmers in the current food safety proposal is the use of irrigation water meeting the standards of swimming pools. Swimming pool water have absolutely nothing to do with food consumption. So we're looking at making sure FDA is setting standards that are based on actual science.
The Farm Bureau will also focus on the Good Samaritan Hunger Relief Tax Extension Act to create a permanent tax credit to farmers that donate to food banks. The Farm Bureau notes that corporations already have a permanent tax credit for food donations.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
The Environmental Protection Agency wants to improve farm worker safety when it comes to pesticide use and has proposed revisions to its worker protection standard for agricultural pesticides, first established in 1992. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn explains.
Assistant Administrator for the EPA's Office of Chemical Safety and Pollution Prevention, Jim Jones, says the proposed revisions, which carry a 90-day public comment period, aim to protect the nation's 2 million farm workers and their families from pesticide exposure.
This rule covering farms, forests, nurseries, and greenhouses has not been updated in 20 years, and certainly for many, it is long overdue.
Amy Liebman is Director of Environmental and Occupational Health at Austin, Texas-based Migrant Clinicians Network.
For far too long, this essential labor force has been treated as second class. And we're encouraged that these changes will finally afford farm workers stronger safeguards to protect their health, their safety, and their families' health.
The EPA's Jones says the following are a few of the key proposed revisions.
First, annual mandatory training, rather than once every 5 years, to inform farm workers about the protections they are afforded under the law and have the tools they need to protect themselves and their families from exposure to harmful pesticides. Second, mandatory posting of no entry signs for the most hazardous pesticides. The signs prohibit entry into pesticide-treated fields until residues decline. Third, a first-ever minimum age requirement. Children under 16 will be prohibited from handling pesticides.
Chris Pavelski is a fourth-generation onion farmer and owns Pavelski Farms in Orange County's Black Dirt region. He says he plans to comment on the proposed revisions and commends many aspects, such as increasing training to once a year, which Pavelski already practices.
I do it every year for my workers versus every 5 years. I want them to be aware of it, even though on my farm and many of my neighbors' farms, our workers do not handle pesticides. They don't mix. They don't apply. That's something done by my father and brother and I. But I still want them to be aware, and especially for situations like when the crop duster happens to come by, I want them to be fully, understand and trained to get out of the way, leave the field.
However, he says he is concerned about one of the proposals, mandatory posting of signs symbolizing no entry into areas treated with the most hazardous pesticides.
In the case of, for farms in the Black Dirt, you have small 5-acre fields, and you have multiple entry points, those fields are back and front end. You're talking about putting up a lot of signs and taking down and putting up and taking down. That's one thing. Also, for the public sometimes passes through in a lot of the farming areas and stuff, and seeing signs up that, state that, there's hazardous material there doesn't really connote something that's a very positive message or kind of stigmatizes things a little bit that may be, not be necessary.
He says in his case, such a regulation would entail putting up some 20 to 30 signs. The EPA's Jones says such signs would display a universally understood symbol.
A farm worker going into a field that's been treated during a reentry interval, we have found is one of the two biggest causes of acute exposures.
He says the following proposed revision would address the second cause, exposure to pesticides from pesticide drift outside the treated area.
New no-entry buffer areas surrounding pesticide-treated fields on farms will protect farm workers and others from exposure from pesticide overspray and fumes.
Other proposed revisions pertain to respirator use and record keeping. Again, the Migrant Clinicians Network's Liebman.
Currently, farm workers are not afforded the same protections as other workers. In fact, they are specifically excluded from most of the regulations that protect other workers in this country.
In addition, she says farm workers need better protections because the health risks from pesticide exposure, both short and long term, are numerous. An EPA spokeswoman says it is the agricultural employer, that is, the farmer, who would bear the cost of implementing any adopted regulations. She says the state should have no more costs than they do now, such as for inspections and enforcement.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
You're listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Classrooms across the state have been stirred up by Common Core. The Innovation Trail's Ashley Herzl takes a look at how Common Core affects testing and how those tests affect teachers, parents, and students.
I'm all for setting the bar high. You are setting it so high that you're going to defeat a group of people and they're going to drop out of school. I already hear it talking. They say they'll never pass those tests and they're done. And that will be a shame that they will be defeated.
That's parent Lisa Arnone speaking at the Common Core Forum in Jamestown. She says the standardized tests based on Common Core are causing a lot of anxiety for students, parents, and teachers. The controversy over Common Core in the state traces back to 2010, when lawmakers in Albany required districts to come up with a teacher evaluation system. Otherwise, they'd withhold state aid.
The ratings go like this. The highest rating is highly effective. The next rating is effective, then is developing,
and then there is ineffective.
That's Buffalo Teachers Federation President Phil Rumore explaining part of the annual Professional Performance Review Process, or APPR. The leader of the Buffalo Teachers Union says the state also required the evaluation system include a teacher improvement plan for developing ineffective teachers. Regents Chancellor Emeritus Robert Bennett explains how teachers get these ratings.
It's a 100-point scale. The first 60 points are by the local district on classroom observations, feedback. The next 20 would be based on local assessments or portfolio review. Then the last 20 points were based on the new state assessments.
They've made it very difficult for a teacher to get into the highly effective or effective rating. That's the problem.
And Rumore says every point counts on the APPR.
So just the loss of even 10 points can drop you from developing to ineffective or from effective to developing. Although it doesn't sound like much, even 10 points, the way they have the rating skewed, can have a detrimental effect.
Rumore says this process creates a high-stakes testing situation where state tests can make or break a teacher's rating. Parent Karen Champeau says the only way for teachers to best prepare for the assessments is to use the modules provided by the State Education Department.
The promise is that if teachers present the material in the modules to their students and stick to the minute-by-minute schedule, their students will know everything needed to be successful on the test. But there are several problems with using the modules, including the loss of teacher creativity and incomplete resources, since all the modules are not available yet. The modules that do exist are riddled with errors.
Parent and teacher Shannon Stile says there have always been state tests. State testing has been around for close to 150 years, but Stiles noted that now educators are scrambling to prepare for them because they are very different than they were in the past.
Because they're Common Core aligned, the teachers can't see them till the morning of the test. And then they're not allowed to grade their own either, so they go to somebody else to grade. So you never get them back. You never know how your students do. So that's a problem. It's really not helping the teacher evaluate the student in any way. So all these tests are used for is evaluating the teacher.
Parent Molly Dana is one of many that take issue with the fact that those state tests are tied to the teacher evaluations.
It's just unfair. It's labeling our teachers. It's labeling our schools.
And parent Crystal Hagland agrees.
The amount of time and energy spent on tests that actually measure very little and are so skill-specific, in my opinion, is preposterous.
Lakeshore Elementary third grader Aiden Stiles says the Common Core state tests have caused stress and confusion for him and his peers.
It's really hard because we have to do more stuff than just figuring out the answers. And it's a lot different than last year because last year was easier than this year.
Some parents are so enraged by the testing process, they've refused to let their children take the state tests. It won't affect their child's grades or hurt teacher evaluations. Melissa Holden says her fourth grader was so anxious about taking the state assessments, she decided not to allow her to take them. Still, Holden has a warning for parents that if a child makes even a mark on the test, it will be judged as if the child took the test, and then it would negatively affect their teacher. If you don't send your child to school on the day of testing to boycott the exams, your child will then be forced to take a makeup test.
I'd rather have her sitting quietly and reading a book rather than taking those tests because they don't really mean anything.
But New York State Education Commissioner John King maintains that state standardized tests are used to inform instruction.
Defining students or educators simply by test scores, that's not our position now, never has been. The Board of Regents, the department, has always said that student assessments and student performance on assessments should be a factor in how we evaluate student performance along with a variety of other factors.
Phil Rumore adds that the problem isn't really with teacher evaluations. He says teachers don't mind being evaluated if it's fair.
For the state to get standardized tests, which many people have said are developmentally inappropriate, put all sorts of pressure on kids, don't measure creativity, critical thinking, and all the things that we think are important. That's what the problem is. The problem is the testing of our kids, not so much the evaluation.
In Buffalo, I'm Ashley Hertzel.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. Copies are available. Call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1409. Ask for program number 1409. Or just listen to podcast on the web at WAMC.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina. We'll be right back.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.